I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The twisty, turny tale of Stormy Daniels, Donald Trump, and hush money took a surprising, even shocking turn on Wednesday night. That was when Trump's new lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, told Sean Hannity on Fox that Trump had reimbursed his lawyer, Michael Cohen, the $130,000 that Cohen had paid to Daniels to cover up an affair that Trump denies part of a non-disclosure agreement.
Having something to do with paying some Stormy Daniels woman $130,000, I mean, which is going to turn out to be perfectly legal. That money was not campaign money. Sorry, I'm giving you a fact now that you don't know. It's not campaign money. No campaign finance violation.
So they funneled it through the law firm.
Funneled through the law firm, and the president repaid it.
Oh, I didn't know he did.
Yep.
There's no campaign finance law.
Zero.
But do you know the president didn't know about this? I believe that's what
Michael
said.
He didn't know about the specifics of it, as far as I know. But he did know about the general arrangement that Michael would take care of things like this, like I take care of things like this for my clients.
Yikes. This contradicts Trump's and the White House's denying for months that they knew anything about the payment to the porn star. This is just one story in another week of jaw-dropping political and legal news involving, among this story, the Mueller investigation, the Justice Department, Trump's attorney Michael Cohen, and believe it or not, Trump's Dr. Harold Bornstein. We have two guests who have joined us for Radio Times today. Joining us by telephone is Chara Torres-Spellacy. She's Associate Professor of Law at Stetson University and a Brennan Center Fellow. Chara, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Dick Pullman, national political columnist here at WHYY. He writes the National Interest blog. He's also a full-time writer-in-residence at the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing at the University of Pennsylvania. We were talking before the show about how many presidents Dick Pullman has covered. It began with Bush 1. That's 30 years. Dick Pullman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Charlie, let me begin with you. Did Rudolph Giuliani hurt his client on Wednesday night, and there's been some follow-up interviews since then?
I think he did hurt his client. What Rudy said was perplexing in many different dimensions, and it really does open the door to a possible campaign finance violation. So there are a number of ways that the Stormy Daniels payment could violate campaign finance law. Number one, if it's a donation to the campaign, if that's the way the special prosecutor looks at it, then that payment is too big.
$130,000.
Yeah, $130,000 is bigger than $2,700, which was the campaign finance limit at the time. Another problem is it wasn't disclosed, so that also violates campaign finance law. And then the closer legal question is whether this violates prohibitions on personal use of campaign funds. Mm-hmm. So one of the rules of being a federal candidate is that you can't just treat it like a personal piggy bank. And so you can't use campaign funds for personal use. And so there's an argument here that this payment is an in-kind contribution to the Trump campaign, and then Mr. Trump has used it for something that is entirely personal to him, which is not allowed.
Well, I want to pick up on several things, but Dick, let me get you in on the conversation. What did you hear in that interview? And even if you could get into the head of Mueller, what do you think Mueller and his team heard in that interview, Rudolph Giuliani, with Sean Hannity? I have to say that Sean Hannity looked a little flummoxed and even shocked when he heard Giuliani talking about this
right.
arrangement.
Right. Right. Well, when he said Trump paid it, and Hannity said, "I didn't know he did." The overall feeling I have about all this, about what Giuliani said and what the Wall Street Journal editorial criticizing Trump said this morning, and Neil Cavuto on Fox News attacking Trump at length last night, it's like, you know, Trump in some ways needs to obsess less about these external threats like Mueller, because the calls are coming from inside the House now, to use a horror movie trope. So, you know, so what I heard was that what Giuliani was doing was seriously complicating things for Trump on, and I think we're going to cover the legal issue as well, and we're already starting it today, but on the credibility front, the overall political credibility issue that Trump has, because there's a long string of comments going back to March where he basically said, no, I don't know anything about this payment. I had nothing going on. I'll have to ask Michael Cohen, et cetera, et cetera. And then Sarah Huckabee Sanders repeated it to the press corps, you know, saying it's all been denied, nothing's going on. And now you have, you know, Giuliani saying all this, completely contradicting everything that Trump had said before. And it's like on the credibility issue, one of the things that the Wall Street Journal said this morning in the editorial was, you know, we're getting to the point where, you know, if there's like a major crisis, a really serious crisis involving a nuclear confrontation or whatever, you know, how many Americans are going to believe anything he says? And that's almost an exact quote. So, you know, I think what we have here, you know, it's a presidential crisis in that sense, in terms of him, in terms of leadership. And, you know, the legal issues, you know, we can debate about this, and there are some things about the whether this is a campaign-related expenditure or not. You know, the John Edwards, of course, was on trial for this kind of thing when he had an affair, and the jury let him off because they couldn't, they couldn't say that it was entirely linked as a campaign expenditure. So the legal debate can go on, but I think the political ramifications here are serious.
Well, let me do a couple of more quotes. And, of course, this is Rudy Giuliani, in a sense, speaking for President Trump, and this having to do with this payment. And he says, and again, this is looks like he was on Fox and Friends. Imagine if that came out on October 15th, 2016, in the middle of the last debate with Hillary Clinton. He also goes on to say he fired Comey because Comey would not, among other things, say that Trump was not a target of the Russia investigation. So he fired him, and he said, I am free of this guy. Char, going back to you, now you can say these things on TV. I'm not sure you can get away with it in a courtroom. But does that really further implicate President Trump in obstruction of justice?
Well, this isn't the first time that what Rudy Giuliani has said could put Trump and his policies in serious jeopardy. If you'll recall, before President Trump, I think when he was president-elect, Rudolph Giuliani said something to the effect of, we're remaking the Muslim ban as a national ban, and that's the way we're going to get it through the courts. Well, that quote from Rudy Giuliani has shown up in Supreme Court briefs as proof that the Muslim ban is actually aimed at Muslims, which is inappropriate under our First Amendment. And so I think the more recent statements from Rudy, where he talks about, yeah, this was about the campaign, or it would have been really bad if this had come out right at the eve of the election, that is not helping his client. That is, will end up in briefs against Trump if he is ever held to account for these possible violations of campaign finance law.
Dick, we're hearing from reporters who cover the White House that there was just a lot of running around and head smacking and jaws dropping at the White House as this interview was going on. And there's also some reporting that this was something that Rudolph Giuliani and the president basically decided to do together without notifying, apparently, reportedly, anyone else in the White House, including other lawyers.
Yeah, it's a sign of, well, it's just a sign of the ongoing dysfunction. You know, the place is running, you know, off the cuff, on the fly. You know, something Chair said just a second ago, I think was good about the statements and how they're ending up in briefs. I think she would probably agree that we've actually seen some court decisions where judges, you know, have cited statements made by principals around Trump or Trump himself, and they've wound up in the footnotes of some of these rulings. So it's like every time they open their mouth, it's making it worse. But as to your question, yeah, you know, you've got this situation where senior aides are, you know, completely caught flat-footed by what's going on, And they are, you know, for all the talk at the White House about, you know, the fake news media, well, it's Trump's tweets about the fake news media. What's happening day after day after day is that people inside the White House at any number of levels are talking to the so-called fake news media, or what I would call the free and independent press. They're talking to the Washington Post and the New York Times. They're, you know, they're unburdening their angst to the media about, you know, not knowing what's going on. I mean, one of the things that happened during, just by contrast, when Bill Clinton was in crisis during the Lewinsky scandal and the stuff that was sort of spilling out from that, they had, if anybody can go back and actually check this, it's true, you know, they had a fairly coordinated, they had a legal team, they had a communications team, they had a policy team, and they were all kind of working, you know, fairly in sync. I mean, they were under the gun and they, you know, they felt beleaguered. But you didn't have this kind of freelancing going on, and you didn't have people in the Clinton White House spilling about being caught flat-footed. And by, so by the time the scandal was played out and the impeachment was played out, Clinton left office with an approval rating of about 65%. I don't see that happening here.
That's so interesting. And, Charles, let me go back to you, because the president, or I guess the president's legal team, have hired a lawyer that was an impeachment defense attorney for President Clinton to be part of the team. How significant do you think that is?
Well, I am one of those people who actually wants President Trump to have good legal counsel. I don't want him to, you know, fail in his legal cases, you know, because he has inadequate counsel. So I am actually pleased that Mr. Flood is his new counsel, because he's a serious lawyer and a serious person. And you need serious lawyers when you're facing this type of legal jeopardy. So I am one of those people who actually wants him to have the best attorneys in the country to help him defend himself, because everyone actually deserves a strong legal defense. And that being said, I think it's a very interesting choice to go with a attorney who has experience in impeachment, which is a very rare skill set. We haven't had that many impeachments of presidents. We've had two. They've actually both ended in acquittal, so we've never actually removed a president from the Oval Office through the impeachment process. The closest we've gotten was with Nixon, who was on the verge of being impeached when he resigned.
Well, Chera, hold on to that thought. I want to pick up on several things that you have said, Dick Pullman, as well. We are going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with Chera Torres-Spellacy. She's Associate Professor of Law at Stetson University, also a Brennan Center Fellow. And Dick Pullman, National Political Columnist here at WHYY, where he writes the National Interest Blog. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with our guest today about the week in news, and there's been a lot of news this week. And again, you can join our conversation. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to be part of this conversation. Charles, let me go back with you, and just to underscore what you're saying here. I appreciate the fact that everyone in this country should have good lawyering. And I wonder, in this particular case, because there's just so many tentacles to this case, it has divided the country. There are people that have chosen sides based on their politics and a whole bunch of other things, that if he doesn't have a good lawyer, then this will never end.
Well, it'll end one way or another. I've never seen a president who had as many legal issues as President Trump does. I mean, it's everything from the non-disclosure agreements with playmates, porn stars. Like, it's almost like comically bad. And I think the more serious part of this is the question of what his campaign did vis-a-vis foreign donors. And if you'll allow me, there are things that are close legal questions, like the personal use with the Stormy Daniels payment. That may go nowhere. There are clear violations of campaign finance law that happened in the 2016 election. And the clearest example is the Trump campaign was soliciting donations from parliamentarians, as in members of parliament in Australia, in the UK, and all of those solicitations for money were totally illegal. And if I were Robert Mueller, I would start there, because that is low-hanging fruit and a clear violation, and you don't have all of, like, I don't know, the ambiguity that you have in other parts of Trump's potential criminal liability.
Plus, you've got two countries who are, you know, friendly to the United States versus whatever may involve Russia and oligarchs in Russia. Dick, let me go back to you and you know, I've done a number of interviews, as you have, with people who followed Trump as he was building up his casinos in Atlantic City, his business dealings in New York. And there are some familiar patterns here that we see in terms of the kind of chaos that we see around it. Bankruptcies, not paying people, accusations, exaggerations, falsehoods. Do you see some parallels here?
It's a behavioral pattern. And, you know, it's funny you said about paying or not paying. It's great that he paid back Michael Cohen, because the Atlantic City subcontractors who he stiffed would probably feel envious today. But this behavioral pattern is been going on really since the early 70s, where he is used to sort of creating, who's that character in Peanuts who stirred up the dirt? Which one is Linus? Is it Linus?
Someone will correct.
Pigpen.
Pigpen, thank you.
Thank you, Char.
Okay, good. All right, so Pigpen, stirring up the dirt. You know, he's used to kicking up dust, and so he's been embroiled in legal disputes since he was very young, and, you know, his father was, and then he was, and he, as he says in the White House, where's my Roy Cohn? He's been saying that. Where's my Roy Cohn? Well, Roy Cohn died in 1986. But the pattern now, what he saw this week with Giuliani, when Giuliani said on TV that the FBI agents were stormtroopers. Now, if you go back to, and I was going to write about this today but didn't get to it yet, but if you go back to when the Department of Justice was suing Trump in the early 70s, he and his father, for not renting his apartments to African Americans, and they had him nailed for that. And they got into a big dispute. And so he hired Roy Cohn. And what Roy Cohn did was, punch back twice as hard. And so what he did was he said at that time that that the Department of Justice and the lawyers and the people in the home office in Washington were stormtroopers. He used a lot of used a lot of the same over-the-top terminology, Gestapo tactics. He said, that's another quote. And it was the same exact stuff that we're hearing now from Giuliani. And so this is his pattern, is to basically, someone hits him, he wants to hit back twice as hard, and he wants to, if he can't question on the fact, what's that thing about with lawyers say, if you can't get them on the facts, you pound the table. I'm slightly misquoting.
Sure, you might want to correct that.
So it's something like that. So he pounds the table. He pounds the table. And so that's the pattern. We're seeing it now. If they have you nailed on facts, you try to undercut the inquiry itself. And that's what he's doing with Mueller.
Which, Chair, raises the question about, you know, what works in the business world. And clearly Trump has been able to be a relatively successful businessman, but whether that works when you're president of the United States.
I don't think it does work. A lot of the skill sets that got him to be successful in business or even as a reality TV star are not going to work in a White House environment where every statement he makes, whether he makes it in person or on Twitter, will be dissected by a very intelligent press corps. And he is literally being fact-checked by all of the papers of record right now. And I think one of them has him at 3,000 lies in his presidency, which is ridiculous. And so I think this lying has clearly served him well in the business world, but at some point he has to pay a political price for it.
I'm looking at, it's the Washington Post that keeps track of all of this. This was as of a couple of days ago, so it might be more than this. 3,001 false or misleading claims since being in office, an average of 6.5 misleading claims a day. Let me just read an email from Ed from Lansdale. Could the events of this week, the admission that Trump repaid Cohen for Daniels' hush money, whether or not this action is an illegal campaign contribution, could this finally get Trump's tax returns released for public scrutiny? Should Mueller subpoena them? And this is, Dick, one of those questions I think that's been hanging over this whole the campaign and now, of course, the presidency. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah.
And do you think that would be the sort of revelation that people think it might be?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, now we know that at the time of the election in 2016, we didn't know about his health. We didn't know about the hush money.
Well, we knew
stuff.
He was the healthiest person
that ever lived.
The healthiest
person since Zeus, I guess. And we didn't know about the hush money, and we didn't know, and we still don't know about the tax returns, which every president, sort of starting in the Watergate era, has voluntarily released. We still don't know that. And see, one of the things is we only know a fraction of what Robert Mueller knows already. And for all we know, Mueller has those tax returns. Yeah, you know, they might have been on a disc in Michael Cohen's office. It could have been seized already. We don't know what we don't know. We perhaps will know maybe when he starts issuing reports. You know, there are rumors or whatever you want to call them that we might start seeing some reports this summer. So, yeah, but it's all – everything's connected, as they used to say on the Wire TV show. Everything's connected. So the tax returns are connected to the investigation with the to whatever ties he has with Russian oligarchs at whatever time period. So, you know, a lot of this – everything right now is about, you know, who's controlling the narrative. And Trump is all about controlling his own narrative, which is why he used to call the gossip columnists in New York 30 years ago under the name John Barron to say who he was wanted to date, etc. It's all about controlling the narrative through the press. This is how he – this is the way he operates. And right now he's, you know, he's being contested. He's being confronted with a counter narrative that he can't control.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. I do want to play another clip. That's Dick Pohlman, national political columnist here at WHYY. He writes the National Interest blog. Chera Torres-Spellacy is joining us by telephone. She's associate professor of law at Stetson University, also a Brennan Center fellow, talking about the week's worth of news. There's a lot of news with political and legal implications. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play another clip, and this is Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, and he's speaking at the Newseum. This is in Washington, D.C., celebrating Law Day on Tuesday.
Now, there have been people who have been making threats privately and publicly against me for quite some time, and I think they should understand by now the Department of Justice is not going to be extorted.
The Department of Justice is not going to be extorted. Chera, as a lawyer yourself, how unusual is it to have the president to also have Rudolph Giuliani talk about, you know, FBI stormtroopers going into Michael Cohen's office? What do you make of this language about the Justice Department and the Attorney General, for instance?
It's actually deeply troubling. We are a country where we have the rule of law. And part of what it means to have the rule of law is that no one is above the law. And that includes presidents, presidents' daughters, presidents' lawyers. We are not an oligarchy yet. And language like that is very dangerous.
Well, and there are, Dick, some Republican members of, I think it's the House of Representatives, who are in the process or have even drafted articles of impeachment of Rosenstein. I mean, he's getting it from And there, every last couple of weeks, there are news stories, is Rosenstein going to make it through the weekend or not without getting fired by the president?
Yeah.
He's really in the center of a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, well, it's a way to sort of go get at Mueller without firing Mueller, which would be the flashpoint. But I think what's interesting here, it's a little paradoxical in a way that, you know, we talk about how, you know, Trump always riffs in the moment, that he has nothing planned beyond the next minute. And that's true as far as it goes. But there's also, by the same token, he's playing a long game in another way, which is that bad stuff is coming. I think they've gotten this through to him, that bad stuff is coming. And so he's trying, through his allies in the aspects of the conservative media and on some of them on Capitol Hill, as you just mentioned, Marty, to try to, generate enough doubt, I would say unreasonable doubt, about the Justice Department and about the investigation and how this is just a conspiracy that's out to get him, in order to keep his 35-40% support level solid. Because there's the political tribalism right now is so intense that they will stand by him for anything. So basically, he's trying to sort of, you know, he's trying to stack, you know, stack the bricks around his castle to withstand all the arrows coming at him, if I go with that metaphor. Because the long game here is that his political advisors, I think, have told him, you know, the House is in jeopardy here in the midterms. And if the Democrats take the House, which is more than 50-50, I think, chance right now, impeachment proceedings, serious impeachment proceedings, or at the very least, serious investigations with Adam Schiff at that point leading one of the key committees, that his legal turmoil and political turmoil is going to deepen. So he's trying to get ahead of it by... That's, again, a thing about creating a narrative, at least to hold his support as solid as he possibly can to try to withstand everything coming at him.
Chara, the New York Times released questions. This is as a result of a meeting between Trump's lawyers, I believe it was in early March, and members of the Mueller investigation to talk about an interview with the president. Apparently, Jay Sekulow, who works for the president, then put whatever conversation they had into a series of questions, which then the New York Times printed and did some descriptions of. And I'll just read a couple of them here. And these would be questions put to the president. What was the purpose of your January 27th, 2017 dinner with Comey? And what was said regarding the decision to fire Comey? When was it made? Why? Who played a role? What did you mean when you told Russian diplomats on May 10th, 2017 that firing Comey had taken the pressure off? What did you mean in your interview with Lester Holt about Comey and Russia? Did any of these questions, as you looked at them, Char, did they seem off target or in some ways not helpful to the situation?
All of these questions seem pertinent to the investigation that Robert Mueller is looking at. So on the one hand, he has a mandate to look at what was the relationship between Russia and the Trump campaign. That's his main mandate. But he also has a mandate to investigate any crimes that he sort of stumbles upon along the way. And we've already seen that with the indictments of Paul Manafort, who was Trump's campaign manager. And those indictments are actually about money laundering and tax evasion and Paul Manafort's relationship with the Ukraine, which actually preceded him being Trump's campaign manager. But I have to think that he also has another indictment waiting for Paul Manafort that may be related to what happened between Russia and the Trump campaign. We just have to wait and see. Oh, we don't know yet.
Tell us what you think you're referring to or you're referring to there, Chara.
So there was one of the questions that the New York Times published as reportedly a question that Mueller wants to ask the president, which was, in essence, and I'm paraphrasing, what did Manafort do in reaching out to the Russians, which is a big red flag that there may be a problem here.
Well, you know, Dick, questions have been raised about how far, I guess, from his original mandate Mueller can go. But I certainly remember from the Clinton days, that began with Whitewater, right, and ended up with Monica Lewinsky.
Mm-hmm. Well, these things can, like any investigators would tell us, you have to take things where they go. And, you know, once you have a little ball, you have a ball of yarn and you keep following it. And sometimes the ball gets bigger because things get connected. And I don't have in front of me, I know I've quoted it in what I've written in the past, but I don't have in front of me what his mandate from the Rosenstein and the Justice Department is. But it's pretty broad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not meant to hem him in. And, you know, I guess a few months ago there was this thing going around that Ty Cobb, now departed from the legal team, was saying, or at least according to Trump, it was going to be over. The thing was going to be over by December. And, you know, many of us who saw that at the time said, yeah, sure. And of course it's not, because, you know, the string of the complications of where money is moving, follow the money, it's all over the world. And, Mueller has his team of financial experts. And so, of course, it's still going on. And so, this is the part that has, you know, Trump, I think, completely, you know, unhinged, is not knowing where the end game is going to be.
Yeah. Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about the week in news, talking about Rudy Giuliani's interview on Fox News on Wednesday night. Also talking about those questions that were published in The New York Times. We do want to talk about Donald Trump's doctor after this very short break and some other things as well. Dick Pullman and Chera Torres-Spellacy are guests. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Marty Moss Cohen talking with our guests, but also looking at the TV here. And the president is talking to reporters about Rudy Giuliani and the interview, saying he just got started. He's a great guy. He'll get his facts straight. So there's some question about where the president stands when it comes to what Rudolph Giuliani said. Dick, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I want to quote Sir Walter Scott, the Scottish poet, who said...
From Peanuts to Walter Scott, right?
Yeah, I'm ranging far and wide, who said, what a tangled web we weave when we first practice to deceive.
Mm.
And so now he's saying, now Trump in the moment is saying... Giuliani might have gotten some things wrong when he went on TV, and he said, quote, he'll get his facts straight. He just started. So I'm sure Giuliani will feel terrific about that. Although there's one thing that Giuliani said on TV the other night that I forgot to mention that I think Trump would still agree with, and it was a curious thing. He was saying Ivanka, he was speaking up for Ivanka, and goes, Ivanka, you know, a fine young woman, come on, we don't want to, you know, it sounded like, come on. He said, like, let's not go after her. And then he said that Ivanka's husband,
Jared,
is, quote-unquote, disposable. And I'm thinking, you know, if that reflects Trump's thinking, which I'm pretty sure it would, it's a sign of how serious actually they are taking this, that they're thinking that they may have to draw the line around the biological family.
Wow.
I mean, that's the way I interpret that.
Charles, let me go back to you. And there was a question about whether Mueller can subpoena the president, what the president can or can't do if he is subpoenaed. There's also a question about whether this would be a perjury trap or not. Can you speak to that?
So everyone can be subpoenaed.
There you go.
including the president. I assume this is going to turn into an epic fight. And so this may be a question that gets litigated all the way to the Supreme Court. The two analogous cases have gone against presidents in the past. So there's the Nixon case where he was trying to exert executive privilege over his White House tapes, and the Supreme Court said, no, you have to hand over those tapes in a criminal trial. The other case was the Clinton case, where he's being sued by Paula Jones. And there, Clinton was asserting that I'm too busy as president. I can't sit for a civil trial. And the Supreme Court said, no, the president has to sit for a civil deposition in a civil trial.
Hmm.
So I assume that they will look at those precedents, they will apply them to these facts, and they will say to President Trump, you must testify.
Dick.
Or, you know, show up to the grand jury and plead the fifth, but you can't not show up.
And he's entitled to plead the fifth.
He is entitled to plead the fifth, like every American.
Like every American. Did you want to add something, Dick?
Yeah, I mean, this, I think, dovetails in some ways with what Chair is saying, which is that, well, it, there's an argument that the Trump legal team might welcome a subpoena, in the sense that, okay, maybe they would lose in the end for the reasons that Shara just said, but it's going to take a while to play out. So they can drag this out, you know, for many, many months. And that's another old Roy Cohn tactic, used to just drag stuff out forever. You know, when Nixon, when the courts went against Nixon, those of us old enough to remember, that was dragged out over a long period of time, relatively speaking. And meanwhile, if that's what happens, you know, you got to go through all the courts and all that, and everybody gets to argue it. But meanwhile, as it's being dragged out, he still Trump also does his parallel narrative campaign with his base, you know, to talk about how everybody's out to get him and to shore up that political support.
Charles, let me ask you about a perjury trap. If you're telling the truth in a court, do you have to worry about a perjury trap?
Not at all. In some ways, there's no such thing as a perjury trap. There is, you go into a legal proceeding, whether it's a deposition or a trial, you're sworn to tell the truth, you tell the truth, and you know, you let the chips fall where they may. It's only a perjury trap if you are... you know, have a habit of lying, and or you find it difficult to tell the truth. So I think the whole construct of a perjury trap is, I don't know, sort of absurd if you are an honest person.
We're talking to you, and there's also all sorts of things happening around us. Apparently, this just in things that Trump just said, no one wants to speak to the special counsel more than me. That's a quote there. And also, I'd love to talk to Mueller. So if he were your client, Chera, what would you advise Donald Trump to do or not to?
Well, it's hard to say. In part, I don't like pretending that I am Donald Trump's lawyer in any capacity. So, and part of why I'm hesitant to answer that question is I actually don't know what the underlying facts are here.
Right.
I don't know what he did with Russia. I don't know what he did with the porn star. I don't know. Like, so I'm going to respectfully not answer that question.
Well, I actually respect that. Go ahead, Dick.
Well, I think we've gotten these reports that a number of his lawyers, I'm not sure if there's the ones that were still there or not, you know, were nervous about him talking to Mueller because I think in part because they probably don't know everything, you know. I'm not a lawyer, but I've been around cases enough to know where lawyers basically say, you know, we don't get, you know, don't surprise us. You know, we have to know what's going on here in order to effectuate our best defense. And if they don't know what he's going to say when he goes in and talks to Mueller, then how can they feel confident that he should do so? And so therefore, you know, you step back and then you try to fight it. But, you know, the thing about taking the fifth that we talked about before, yes, he has that right to take the fifth if it comes to that. And Michael Cohen has already said he's taking the fifth. But it's great to go back through Trump's past tweets, because you can always find something that contradicts where he is today. And in 2016, when some very low-level techies working for the Clinton campaign were called and took pled the fifth, he put out things saying, oh, that's just something that mob figures do, you know, because it means that you're guilty.
Let me read an email from Gary from Malvern. He says, do you remember when Trump had to close down his nonprofit foundation because he was siphoning off monies for his own personal use? Doesn't Trump's using campaign funds as his own piggy bank show the same pattern of behavior? Chair, I don't think we know enough to answer that. Maybe you do, but any thoughts to Gary from Malvern?
Well, one thing that I find sort of almost comical about where we are with campaign violations by the Trump campaign, it is actually really difficult to find a law in campaign finance that you can violate because this area of the law has been so deregulated by the Roberts Supreme Court. But they found some of the only things that are still enforced. So those are the ban against foreigners giving to federal candidates. You can't ask for that money. You can't accept that money. You also can't accept in-kind donations from a foreigner. And one of the only other places that the Department of Justice enforces the campaign finance law is against personal use. So he has figured out a way in a otherwise completely deregulated campaign finance environment to somehow break the two laws that DOJ still cares about.
And you think that's what Mueller's looking at?
It is entirely possible. I can't see through Steele, and he has walled himself off quite effectively, so I have no idea if that's what he's looking at, but they're definitely candidates for potential crimes.
Let me just give out that phone number again. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation, trying to make sense of the last couple of days of news. Let me play one more clip, and this is an excerpt from President Trump's former doctor, Harold Bornstein. He's speaking to NBC News about a raid on his office last year. This was shortly after the Donald Trump became president, and the fact that Dr. Bornstein had told a reporter about a drug that Trump was taking for his hair. Let's give it a listen.
I feel raped. That's how I feel. Raped, frightened, and sad. I couldn't believe anybody was making a big deal about a drug that's to grow his hair, which seemed to be so important. And it certainly is not a breach of medical trust to tell somebody they take Propecia to grow their hair. What's the matter with that? I was completely surprised the morning or two after the story about his hair ran. She said, so you wanted to be the White House doctor? Forget it. You're out.
What exactly were they looking for?
All his medical records, his pictures, anything they could find. They must have been here for 25 or 30 minutes. It created a lot of chaos. Never in 30 years had I ever talked about Donald Trump or that with anybody who didn't work in this facility. Never.
Dick, he's kind of all over the place, and that's a slightly edited clip there. But it sounds as if there was a raid on this doctor's office, and mm-hmm. the explanation from the White House it was that this is kind of typical from one administration to the other to get a president's personal medical information. Does mm-hmm. this raise any red flags for you?
Well, that sounds like almost like, you know, 20 dust-ups ago already, doesn't it?
It does.
Sarah Sanders said it was, quote-unquote, standard operating procedure. But, you know, the medical office, the White House medical office didn't go over there, number one. He sent his personal bodyguard and a lawyer from the Trump organization, from the company, and an unidentified third person that the doctor said was a large man who has not yet even been identified. So that's number one. It was kind of an odd group that went over. Number two, there's no evidence, and certainly Sanders didn't offer any to the press, that they had signed, Trump had signed what we all call a HIPAA form, you know, the privacy, an authorization to go over there and get material. So there was no apparent paperwork in that regard. But number three, perhaps most importantly, under New York law and under a lot of other state laws, the original medical records are the property of the physician and stay there for at least a six, seven year period from the last, you know, examination. So the originals belonged to Bornstein, but they took the originals. They were supposed to have HIPAA request to get copies, and they took the originals. So on all those levels, it sounds like it was, you know, a sort of peremptory abuse. And, you know, I don't know, there's been nothing in the press about whether Bornstein wants to press charges, that this was some kind of theft. But it seems to me that the grounds would be there for that if we have, you know, yet another offshoot of everything we've been talking about.
Yeah,
today.
And Shara, as our resident lawyer here, are there some red flags for you? Do you think laws were broken?
And this is very similar to the campaign finance violations. So they managed to turn what should just be sending in a HIPAA form to a doctor to get a copy of medical records. They turned that into an event which could be characterized as a burglary. And they seem to have this, a thuggish way of interacting with the world, and at some point this is going to catch up with them, in part because we have a special counsel whose day must start with looking at the news and seeing if another crime has been committed. It is a very, very strange time to be alive.
Well, we're almost out of time here. Dick, I just wanted to pick up on something you had written about the fact that earlier this week Paul Ryan had fired the congressional priest,
the chaplain.
It's unclear exactly why he was fired, but there was some question about a speech that, or I guess a blessing that he gave about the poor as this tax plan was going into effect or being debated. But now we find he apparently reversed himself on his own resignation, and Speaker Ryan unfired him.
He unfired him. Nobody knows what that's all about. Talk about dysfunction. You know, and we're all speculating about why he unfired him, and now he's saying he can stay. And the only real logical explanation for that I can see is that Ryan does not want to be drawn out on exactly why he was wanted him to leave in the first place. And of course, you know, the prayers he was giving, saying that the tax cut bill should be fair to everyone. Is the thing that apparently stuck in his craw, at least reportedly. So, you know, we don't know that either, but that's just let another little dust up. That would, in any normal times, would be getting a lot more attention. But very quickly, the thing about the raid,
yes,
on the office. 45 years ago or so, when Nixon's plumbers raided Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office to get Ellsberg's records, they at least had a sense that it was wrong. And because they did it in the middle of the night, you know, these people just stormed in there in the middle of the day, like it was no big deal, like it was, you know, that they could just go ahead and do this stuff, and it didn't matter if everybody knew about it. And so there's something that's changed there about our moral compass.
On that note, my thanks to both of you, Dick Pohlman, national political columnist at WHYY, where he writes the National Interest blog. Dick, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Chara Torres-Spellacy, Associate Professor of Law at Stetson University, and she's a Brennan Center Fellow. Chara, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and John Ahrens with Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.